Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
When Iran's soccer team played South Korea, the fans had their mind on a bigger clash at home.
They are doing something that has not been done for 30 years. The people were quiet for 30 years. They were shut down and their voice would not be heard in anywhere else. But now is the time that their voice is being heard in all of the world.
No winner in the soccer game between South Korea and Iran. It was a 1-1 draw abroad. But at home, who knows what the end result will be. We're following the action in Tehran this morning on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Thursday, June the 18th. I'm Femi Okay. John Hockenbury is away, but Catherine Lamford is here. Morning, Catherine.
Hey, good morning, Fem. Coming up this hour, we'll, of course, keep you constantly updated on the latest in Iran. We're also going to chat with New York Times editor Bill Keller. He just left Tehran. Plus, some economists can see the end of the recession, so why aren't they smiling? Those stories coming up, but first, these headlines.
In Iran, a spokesman for the country's top legislative body is asking all three defeated candidates in the country's contested presidential election to attend a meeting on Saturday. That's according to Iranian state radio. A spokesman for that body, the Guardian Council, says that it's now reviewing the many complaints about the election. Incumbent President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad was declared the winner. Protesters say the voting was rigged. Meanwhile, that meeting isn't keeping primary challenger Mir Hussein Mousavi from holding a rally today. He's urging protesters to wear black to the rally, and he's declared a day of mourning for those who were killed in protests this last week. Catherine.
Staying overseas, at least 8 people are dead after a suspected U.S. missile strike in Pakistan. A Pakistani official says it hit the hideout of a Taliban commander in the country's northwest. It's not known if the dead are local tribesmen or militants. Meanwhile, in Washington, the debate between the U.S. and Israel over West Bank settlements is kicking up in public. Israeli Foreign Minister Avigdor Lieberman said Israel will not heed a U.S. request to stop settlement building.
We cannot accept this vision about absolutely, completely freezing of settlements. I think that we must keep the natural growth.
Now, Lieberman was speaking right next to Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, who reemphasized the Obama administration's interest in seeing a halt to the settlement building.
I think that the whole issue that you've raised is one that we've expressed our opinion on.
Now, Clinton also said that there had been no previous agreement with Israel on the settlements under the Bush administration.
Meanwhile, another cabinet member will be in the hot seat on Capitol Hill today. Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner is expected to explain the new plan to overhaul the nation's financial regulatory system. And there's some key economic indicators out this hour, jobless claims from last week. So, Catherine, economists are saying that the recession might end this summer. We'll have more of that coming up on the show. The question is, do you believe them, listeners? Tell us how you know if the economy is getting better by filling in the blank. So when I see the blank, I know the economy is getting better. 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. Send us an email.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at KnightFoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
John Hockenberry is away. I'm Catherine Lanfer.
And I'm Femi Okay. So protesters continue to demonstrate their disappointment with the presidential election results in Iran. So we're beginning this morning by going live to Tehran, where Iranians are getting ready for a day of mourning organized by the opposition leader, Mir Hussein Mousavi. So joining us from Tehran is Fanez Fasahi, Fasihi. Sorry, Fanez. She's the Middle East correspondent for the Wall Street Journal. Fanez, thank you for joining us. Can you set the scene? We're just a little bit away from the protests by the Musavi protesters.
Hi, thank you for having me on. The protesters are starting to gather at a square in downtown Tehran where they're supposed to have a quiet sit-in for the victims of this week's violence. There have been, I think, officially about 15 deaths and many arrests and many people injured in the violent riots. Mir Hossein Mousavi, the opposition leader, is supposed to be there addressing the crowds. As you've probably heard, foreign journalists have been banned from covering the events and reporting them. Therefore, the news that I have is from friends and associates who are there or who are planning to go.
How are you getting this information back to you? How do you feel that you're even getting an accurate version of the story if you can't even get down to the protests?
Well, this is fairly new. It's the ban was enforced yesterday. You know, it's not that difficult to assess what's going on because you know, there's, as you mentioned, citizen journalism is in full swing in Iran. Every Iranian is now a camera man or woman and a photojournalist. They're recording everything and uploading it pretty quickly, so we can assess the crowds. We also have local reporters who are whom we trust and friends and family members who are attending the protests, whom we call. It's becoming very difficult to report the story because of the restrictions and because also mobile phones get cut off every evening, starting around the time of the protests until the next morning. So communication is difficult. Internet speed has become very slow. So it's not easy, but I think that you know, information does manage to get around.
Yeah. Tell us what you can see. Like, what do the streets look like?
Are unusually quiet during the day. A lot of the shops are closed. There's much less traffic than normal in Tehran streets. A lot of people are not sending their kids to school this week because the riots have been unpredictable. Streets are sometimes blocked, and parents worry about you know, their kids getting trapped in a particularly riot, you know, violent area. So it has a strange feel to the city. But around the areas where the riots are, you know, I passed by the highway near where the riots were yesterday, and there was lots of traffic and lots of people marching down, you know, wearing a green wristband or a green scarf or a green shawl. So you definitely feel that something is stirring in the city.
Just before we leave you, give us a sense of how far you feel Mousavi is behind this confrontation. It feels like a confrontation today. In terms of how much is he driving the protesters?
I think that protesters has become a grassroots social movement at this point. What you see is that people decide where to go the next day and they tell one another. I mean, today's protest has been called by Mr. Mousavi's campaign. So I think to some extent he is the leader of the pack. He you know, his campaign does tell people where to come and then people spread the word. But I think it sort of, you know, goes both ways. The people are coming out in strong numbers to show support, and he's so far put out statements to indicate that he's supporting them.
Okay.
I think the key thing... Sorry.
Thank you. Thank you very much. We're going to leave it there. Fanez Fasihi, she's the Middle East correspondent for the Wall Street Journal. Thank you for giving us an update on what's happening on the streets of Tehran. Also joining us this morning, fresh from his trip to Iran, covering the elections there and the protests, is Bill Keller. He's the executive editor of our partner at the New York Times, and he joins us from London. Good morning, Bill.
Good morning.
So, editor of the New York Times, you actually went to marshal your forces out there in Iran, Tehran, and see how they were doing, and then you started writing.
Mm-hmm.
Why?
Well, you know, I do these kinds of trips a few times a year. I think editors should get out and spend some time with their correspondents. You know, that's the only way you can really get a sense for the nuances and texture of the stories that we run. I generally don't write when I'm there. I just watch. But you know, this story just exploded while I was there, and it was kind of all hands on deck.
When you were there, did you get a sense that you were writing history? I'm following some of your reporters' notebooks. You talk particularly on the day after the vote of people almost coming down from this awful high and feeling a great deal of despair.
Yes. I mean, you know, you have to be careful about analogies across cultures, but I've, in my reporting days, covered a couple of pretty historic moments, including the end of the Soviet Union and the end of apartheid, and this felt like it was in that category. Whether the outcome will be similar is impossible to tell at this point, but yes, it feels like something quite important is going on in Iran.
One of the big stories that has come off the back of the presidential elections in Iran and then the coverage afterwards has been the part played by the internet, by social networking, microblogging like Twitter. Does that make you feel comfortable or do you feel threatened by that?
No, I think that's a truly important phenomenon. It's, you know, Iran is a controlled society, but it's not really a closed society. And one reason it's not is because of things like text messaging and websites, and a lot of Iranians, you know, particularly the middle class, are on Facebook. And it's an important internal phenomenon, an organizing tool for the campaign, and when the government hasn't shut the systems down for the post-election protests as well. And now, as they're trying to basically purge the place of outside press, it'll be incumbent on these systems to supply us with information about what's going on there. I think it's an important, you know, supplement for all of us. It's not perfect. You know, for one thing, the government is reasonably good at shutting down these systems, at least sporadically. And for another thing, Iran is a place that where rumors run rampant, and so it's very hard to know, if you're not there witnessing it, you know, how much of the stuff that comes across Twitter you can trust.
Right. Catherine,
it's also interesting. I want you to talk about how you were able to do some reporting there and write when we hear all these other stories of reporters who are told that they can't. If you're on the outside looking in, how come one guy gets to write and one doesn't?
I'm on the outside myself now. I mean, I left when my visa expired.
Right, but you were writing from there.
Right, I was writing from there, and our other reporters have been too. The people who stopped writing first were the people whose visas expired, and they were told that they would get no extensions, and they gave no extensions that I'm aware of to non-resident press. And then on, Tuesday, midday Tuesday, they announced that all working press were supposed to stop working. That is to say, even if you have a visa, your official press credentials were officially revoked, and they said anybody who went out to cover the story would be taking, you know, the risks in their own hands. And people did anyway. People have kept writing. A lot of them have anyway. But it's another thing to just stay on illegally when your visa expires, because it is a relatively efficient police state.
As you were writing your reporter's notebooks, you were saying that change was too unsettling. Are you sticking with that analysis, or as the days go by, do you feel that there's some other explanation for what's happening right now?
You mean, well, change was too unsettling to the leadership, for
yes.
Sure, and to some of the public. I mean, you know, doing a sort of systemic review of public opinion in Iran is extremely difficult. Obviously, most of the reporting focuses in Tehran, which is the capital and a big urban, fairly cosmopolitan place. A lot of Iranians don't live in Tehran, although most Iranians do live in cities of a million or more, so it's a pretty urbanized country. But, you know, that said, Ahmadinejad clearly has a real following. He is a populist and quite a skillful populist politician. He put a lot of money during his 4 years as presidency into sort of spreading the wealth around among civil servants, the military, pensioners, people like that. And there are a lot of Iranians who actually like the kind of paternalistic quasi-theocracy of the Islamic Republic. It makes them comfortable. And there are, as we are seeing, a lot who do not.
Bill Keller is the executive editor for the New York Times. You can read him in the New York Times. Bill, have a safe trip back to the States. Thank you for joining us on The Takeaway.
You're welcome.
Also this morning, we are asking you, when do you know if the economy is getting better? Economists say that the recession may well end this summer, but how do you know that? When I see the blank, I know the economy is getting better. Fill in the blanks for us at 877-8MYTAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. Email us.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Hello there. There are days when John Hockenberry gets up at 2:30 in the morning, but before you feel sorry for him, today is not one of them. John is probably still in bed. We're not better. Bitter. I'm Femi Okeh. Good morning, all.
And I'm Catherine Lanfer. Economic indicators are pointing to some good news. We could see the end of the recession as early as this summer, at the very least, the end of next winter. Happy days, right? Well, we're going to turn to Justin Fox. He's a Time Magazine columnist and editor at large. Okay, Justin, when you look at those indicators, what do you see? Happy days here again?
Define happy. No.
Thanks, Mr. Gloom.
Right, exactly. I think it may be that the recession is ending, nearing an end, although it's kind of funny. Once everyone had sort of come around to that conclusion about a week ago, I mean, even Paul Krugman was saying it in speeches. Most of the indicators since then have been bad, and the stock market is dropping again. But I guess my thought is, okay, there's a good chance the actual recession ends, and that's a good thing. It's better than it not ending. But I don't think that means it's happy days again. I think it's going to be this long economic slog ahead of us for a few years.
All right. So in other words, you're saying if we focus on this question of, is the recession over? We're looking at the wrong question. So what's the right question?
It's what sort of mess do we have to work ourselves through? I mean, the parallel, obviously the parallel of the 30s is brought up all the time. And I think it's a valid parallel. I think we've found ways to avoid things getting that bad or being likely to get that bad in the U.S. The 70s is another good one, where it was just this long, messy period of working through some unsustainable economic trends. And it took – there was a recession in
– there are so many reasons not to want to go back to the 70s.
Right, and it'll be different. I mean, history doesn't repeat itself. It just rhymes. And it's not going to be the same as the 70s. But that same sort of sense of you think you're working your way out of it, and then you get hit by something else.
Wait a minute. This sounds like the recession really won't be over, that instead we're just going to have like the longest, draggiest way out of the recession.
Yeah, or I mean, there were periods in the 70s when the economy was growing, but everybody would be unhappy about something, whether they're clothing or inflation mainly. I think it's much more a sense of, okay, things will get better for a little while, the economy will be growing, and then we'll just get hit by something else. And inflation might be, obviously a lot of people are concerned about that just because the Federal Reserve and other central banks around the world have been reacting to this crisis by printing huge amounts of money. That eventually leads to price increases. I don't know what it's going to be. I just, when you look at it, it seems awfully hard to envision this happy time of flat prices, asset prices rising, house prices rising, stock prices rising that we had from the early 80s through the late 90s.
Give me a snapshot of what our new normal, if you will, is going to be in this post-recession world.
I mean, one of the things, and I'm definitely not the first person to say this, but the normal of the past quarter century was very much defined by asset prices going up, by stocks going up, by house prices going up. And I don't know that they're not going to have to go down all the time, but I think this new normal, that's just not part of the equation. It'll go up sometimes, then they'll go down again. And so we'll have to find other ways to get by and make ourselves happy. I think that's healthier economically over the long run. I don't think you can just rely on asset bubbles to keep the economy going. But I think it takes away this tailwind we've had for a while and gives us headwinds instead.
What about energy? What about taxes? What are our savings accounts?
Well, I mean, the energy, it's really hard to say because I remember the late 70s and we were all convinced that gas prices were going to be high forever. I was a teenager then and thought I'd never be able to afford to gas up a car. And that changed. And so I really hesitate to make this prediction that energy prices are going to be high, but I think they're going to be pretty high. I think we'll find ways to deal with that. And taxes, I don't see anything but a rise in the tax burden just because we've made a lot of commitments. And at some point, we have to pay for them. We've basically been able to borrow our way out of them for a while.
But. So we're going to be paying more for energy. We're probably going to be paying more in taxes. We can't rely on our houses or our stocks to rise and rise and rise and rise.
A lot of bag lunches and fun bicycling trips.
The new frugality,
exactly.
In other words, is also the new normal. Hey, quickly, one of the new normals supposedly is also going to be a reorganized financial system. What's your react to President Obama's reorganization?
It's not quite a reorganization. I mean, you look through it, and there are a lot of smart things that make sense. But in terms of sort of a radical remake of the financial sector, it's not that at all.
Well, what is not radical about it? Because if we're getting more power to the Federal Reserve, they're going to be able to reach in deeper to different financial companies, rearrange them.
Well, they've been reaching in pretty deep and rearranging already. I mean, I think. This whole area of discussion that's been out there, and maybe we'll come back to it later, is this question of whether financial firms should be able to do all these different things that they've been doing, or whether there needs to be some separating and breaking up, both because there are too many of these firms that are too big to fail and you might want them smaller. That's one area of discussion. And also just because maybe the whole Glass-Steagall separation of banks from investment banks wasn't so dumb. And we might need some sort of, maybe not the same, but some sort of separation of really risky activities from essential ones.
Before we let you go, we've been asking everyone what is the item they look at for their economic indicator. So what do you look at?
Well, I mean, I work in the media, and things aren't going so well, and it's not just because of the recession. But if my employer were to start, like, hiring people or expanding or anything, that would be the most convincing economic indicator in the world. I don't know that I'll ever see it.
Justin Fox is an editor-at-large at Time Magazine. He's also the author of a new book, The Myth of the Rational Market, A History of Risk, Reward, and Delusion on Wall Street. Thanks, Justin. Meanwhile, we'd like to know how you would fill in the blank on this sentence. I know when I see the price of blank how the economy is going to turn out. Go ahead. Tell us what your economic indicator is. For Justin, it was if someone in his office got hired. Well, what is it for you? Maybe it's something you see at the grocery.
A pay rise.
Or maybe
the new boss is here. Pay rise. Pay rise.
Or maybe it's being able to take a vacation. There's all sorts of economic indicators. So let's go to mytakeatthetakeaway.org and 877-8. My take.
He's a patient man. Mark Garrison is waiting with the headlines. Just enough time. I feel like John
Hockenberry
doing this to you. Sorry, Mark.
No worries. It's 29 minutes after the hour. We just talked to a reporter in Iran who says protesters are gathering in Tehran for a protest. Eyewitnesses tell our partners at the BBC many are wearing black. The lead presidential challenger called for a day of mourning for supporters who died protesting. On Capitol Hill, a high-level Republican in the Senate is stepping down from his leadership post. Nevada Senator John Ensign admitted to cheating on his wife. And media baron Rupert Murdoch is selling the conservative magazine, The Weekly Standard, to a Denver-based group. That's the news I got. Catherine
Femi.
He's
awesome. He's a speed reader. He's Mark Garrison.
Mark.
Thank you very much.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org and by the Freeman Foundation.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of home, auto, and life insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway.
I'm Catherine Lanfer here with Femi Okay. John Hockenberry's away. We're going to be talking more about Iran and following the protests, all that in a minute. But right now, we're also talking about the economy. Economists say the recession might end this summer. Do you believe them? Tell us how you know the economy is getting better by filling in the blank, as in when I see blank.
then I know the economy is getting better.
Hi, my name is Jack Cunniff. I think that to find a marker that says that the worst of times are behind us isn't to look for lower prices. I think that the better way to find out is when people start to spend money in a discretionary manner, such as going on vacation.
Aha, uh-huh. That's what he looks for. What do you look for? Call us to fill in the blank, 877-8-MY-TAKE, or send us an email, mytake@thetakeaway.org. Danny?
We're also keeping an eye on news coming out of Iran. Our partners, the BBC, are reporting that eyewitnesses in Tehran say that thousands of people, many dressed in black, have gathered in a square in the south of the city. So joining us this morning is a professor who also has his finger on the pulse of what is coming out of Iran almost minute by minute. He's Professor Hamid Darbashi. He's Professor of Iranian Studies at Columbia and the author of Iran, A People Interrupted, and Islamic Liberation Theology, Resisting the Empire. Professor, we caught up with you early this morning, and I'm just wondering, in the last couple of hours, what's been happening that you've been able to monitor coming out of Tehran and Iran?
The rally that is scheduled for 4 o'clock in the afternoon, Tehran time, is in progress. However, the regime, the pro-Ahmadinejad establishment, whichever way you want to call it, has either hacked into pro-Musavi websites or taken them over by force and have been sending mixed signal as to where exactly this demonstration is going to take place. So now what the demonstrators are doing are by physical placards, by physical signs, reminding everyone that the demonstration is actually as scheduled at Imam Khomeini, a major square inside Iran. And then Mousavi has just sent a message that he might appear in person in that demonstration. This is a previously unscheduled event. He might actually go there. So the demonstration is progressing apace. Pictures are already coming out. Some video clips, in fact, are coming out. Thousands upon thousands are gathering. The highways, bridges show just floods of people pouring into that square.
And Mousavi is getting his information out via Facebook.
Via Facebook and via his own personal website, and also a number of pro-Mousavi websites that have emerged in order to make sure that if one is caught, others are still operating. Not all of them are available at one at the same time. You have to navigate two or three of them in order to, at least one of them, to give you the proper information.
Talk about the location of today's gathering. What does it tell us?
They're mostly symbolic places, places that are affiliated with the 1979 revolution. You remember that Mousavi himself is a hero of that revolution, is a character. He was very close to Khomeini. People who love him and admire him, even his elders, address him as the son of Imam Khomeini, as the partner, companion, comrade of Imam Khomeini. So all his revolutionary credentials, all these symbolic signs that were affiliated with the 1979 revolution are being revived and reconfigured and attributed to this movement. So they want to make sure that this revolution, I keep saying revolution, this movement, we don't know if it's a revolution or a civil disobedience, it remains to be seen, is not identified as something instigated by outside. This is what I meant when I was having a conversation with the congressman from Indiana, that this is inspired, this is homegrown, this is grassroots, this is not betraying the ideals of revolution, but in fact is reasserting it.
Now, earlier you spoke to, I'm just going to refer back to Congressman Mike Pence, and he's a Republican from Indiana. His stance was that the U.S. should be supporting the demonstrators. Just going to recap for any of our listeners who weren't around at that point. When you look at international reaction and what's happening inside Iran, where do you think interaction between the two might actually change events?
For example, let's take the United States. Right now, what can happen, there are certain civil rights icons in the United States, such as Jesse Jackson, that are very admired and loved in Iran. They would be people. The United States is an abstraction. You have to see the United States Congress is not the only representation of the United States. Those are the people that we are looking for, Iranians are looking for. Prominent artists, the same people who, in fact, put a video for Obama, they can come and support the movement in Iran. Famous footballers, famous basketball players, famous human rights activists, prominent women rights activists. These are the people that at this moment, American, can go on the record supporting this movement in Iran. Anything and anybody, American, European, other than government, because that is a no-no.
So you want to see Will.i.am from the Black Eyed Peas do a video?
Absolutely. I want to see Congressman Al Sharpton. I want to see Jesse. These are the people that the Iranians want to see on the internet, on television, supporting their cause, but not the Congress.
Professor, you talk with great passion about Iran. I just want to know, just as we wrap up here, do you have an affiliation?
What sort of
In terms of Professor President Ahmadinejad or the
opposition? No, I voted for Mousavi, if that means, and I'm wearing green, as your listeners can't see it, but yes, I have a strong stake in this movement. I still don't know how to characterize it. You see, the revolution keeps dropping out of my mouth involuntarily, but it is an extraordinarily moving experience and a moving phenomenon to be a witness to it. That it is historic, I have no doubt. How will it unfold? I don't know.
Professor Hamid Dabashi, we can hear your passion. We thank you very much for joining us this morning. The professor is a professor of Iranian studies at Columbia University and author of Iran, A People Interrupted, and Islamic Liberation Theology, Resisting the Empire. Now it's time to head over to the news desk. Here's Mark Garrison.
Thank you, Femi. 21 minutes before the hour, and new job numbers are just out a few minutes ago. New weekly jobless claims jumped a bit, though ongoing unemployment insurance filings dipped sharply. A new report makes the connection from those layoff numbers to health care. Employers who offer health coverage could see a 9% surge in cost. PricewaterhouseCoopers says the firm says costs could rise in part because workers are worried about losing their jobs. Those who are worried about this are using their health insurance more while they still have it. NASA is aiming for the moon today. The unmanned rocket launch scheduled this afternoon marks the first moon mission in a decade. Robotic moon probes will hunt for hidden ice. The current manned shuttle mission is on hold until next month. The debate between the U.S. and Israel over West Bank settlements is playing out in public. Speaking right next to the Israeli foreign minister, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton repeated U.S. objections to new settlement construction. The Israeli foreign minister said Israel cannot accept a building freeze. Pakistani officials say at least 8 are dead after a suspected U.S. missile strike. The attacks apparently targeted Taliban hideouts in the country's northwest. Pakistani forces are active in the region, preparing to strike Taliban leaders there. The World Bank is boosting its outlook on China. The bank now says China's economy will grow by 7.2%. That is a real jump, more than a half a percentage point jump from the previous forecast from the World Bank. The new report says the economic stimulus plan in China is apparently having major impact. Catherine Ifemi.
Thank you very much, Mark Garrison.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Hello there. I'm Femi OK.
And I'm Catherine Lanford. Now, today, NASA plans to send probes to the moon in hopes of future exploration. But there's a little thing called their budget that might make their hopes more earthbound. We're going to go now to Miles O'Brien. He is a freelance science and aviation reporter, and we always love to talk to him about things in space. Hey, Miles.
Good morning, Catherine.
Now, first of all, tell me about NASA's financial problems.
Well, NASA's in a bad way. NASA's been told to go back to the moon. President Bush announced that back in January of 2003, this new vision for space exploration after the space shuttle. But the money has not materialized to allow that to happen in a reasonable period of time. So can you get to the moon on a shoestring is a big question. And at NASA right now, there's no good answer except to say it's going to take longer. And the longer time it takes, the longer we're going to have this gap between the space shuttles, which will retire at the end of 2010, and whatever is next.
All right. Now, President Obama unveiled the federal budget last month. He ordered a review of a particular rocket that NASA had hoped to have on launch pads by 2015. Now, this rocket has been amassing quite the history. Tell us about it.
Well, you know, it's interesting. On this day where this mission to the moon is about to go, which is sort of the beginning of this next era for NASA, there's a commission that is scrubbing NASA's plans right now, headed by an aerospace executive, Norm Augustine, which is going through this plan literally down to the most minute detail and trying to decide whether this Ares rocket family that is currently in the works is the right way to go. There's a lot of debate over this right now, and of course, the longer there is debate, the bigger that gap will be and the more the delays will be. The question is Ares the right way to go? Is it time now to switch to a different rocket design that might actually be faster and less expensive?
Hey, if there are space fans out there who are worried that NASA might get defunded, I mean, it used to be that would have been unthinkable.
Well, yes, it would have been, and we're in an era now where it's not a given anymore, and there is a lot of concern that NASA is at this really important and difficult crossroads and doesn't have the kind of support it needs to figure out what is next after the space shuttle. Space shuttle is going away. We know that. The question is there support in Congress? Is there support among the American people to continue a human-piloted space program in this country? A lot of people, I'm sure, don't really realize that the shuttle is going to go away and the U.S. astronauts will have to ride on Russian rockets to go to the International Space Station for 5, 6, maybe 7 years. The question is, do we want to spend the money to continue putting U.S. astronauts in space? And I'm not sure there's been a resounding answer from the American people or Congress.
All right. And let's just focus on what's happening today, the mission
today. Well, the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter and its twin spacecraft, Lunar Crater Observation Sensor, will head off to the moon. The LRO will spend a year mapping the moon, looking for suitable landing sites, looking for the possibility of ice crystals. And its twin will actually crash into the moon in the fall, kick up some dust in a deep crater that is shadowed and we can't really see. And in that dust, they may be able to see some ice crystals.
Okay, I was just going to say, we're going to have our own crash landing here. Thanks a lot, Miles O'Brien. He is a freelance science and aviation reporter, and he's our go-to guy for things in space.
Is there life on Mars?
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to helping safeguard businesses and employees through comprehensive insurance products and services. More information at libertymutualgroup.com. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
It's Femi Okeh and Catherine Lamfer with you this morning. Have you heard the news? Economists say the recession might end this summer. But do you believe them? Tell us how you'll know if the economy is getting better by filling in the blank. What am I talking about? Have a listen to this.
Good morning, Troy calling from North Dakota. I have a government job, which are notorious rumor mills, and to me, a sure sign that the economy is out of recession is going to be that I'm going to have a steep drop-off in the endless rumors that we hear now about the plant closing or reconfiguring or being acquired by a larger office or something like that.
What is your sign that the economy is getting better? Share your ideas with us, 877-8-MY-TAKE, or send an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. Now time for some news headlines from Mark Garrison.
Thank you, Femi. 12 minutes before the hour, and numerous eyewitness reports are coming in from Iran of protesters massing in Tehran. Presidential challenger Mir Hossein Mousavi called for protesters to wear black today. He's declared a day of mourning for those killed in protests. Also in Iran, a spokesman for the country's top legislative body is asking all three candidates contesting the election to join a Saturday meeting. That's according to Iranian state media. The Guardian Council, that's the top legislative body, says it's now reviewing the many complaints about the election. Incumbent President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad was declared the winner. Protesters say the voting was rigged. The security minister in the East African country of Somalia has been assassinated in a suicide bombing. The president blames the attack on al-Qaeda. And Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner will spend today on the Capitol Hill hot seat. He'll explain the administration's plan to overhaul the nation's financial regulations to Congress. The administration's goal is increased oversight and closing of what it calls regulatory gaps. Government investigators are criticizing America's efforts to stop the flow of guns from the U.S. to Mexico. They say there's no clear plan to fight gun runners linked with drug cartels. That's according to a Government Accountability Office report being presented to Congress today. Finally, Chrysler will reopen 7 assembly plants by the end of June. That comes after it stopped work at all its factories for 6 weeks while under bankruptcy protection. Catherine Femi.
Mark Garrison, thanks for the latest.
health industry groups are expected to deliver.
If you like the plan you have, you can keep it.
To take over the healthcare system, either directly or indirectly, for the government to control it.
A lot of my friends, where they get their healthcare from is the emergency room. They're in the emergency room every week. They break a nail in the emergency room.
How are you going to avoid not having the ability to cost shift as you shrink that portion of privately funded health insurance?
We've been talking all week about health care. President Obama has this prescription for health care reform: cut the costs, keep the quality care. That's easy to say. How do you put it into practice? For answers, we're going to turn to Dr. Elliot Fisher. He is the lead investigator for the Dartmouth Atlas. That's a 20-year-plus project that examines the wide variation in Medicare use and cost across the nation. He's also a professor of medicine and the director of the Center for Health Policy Research at Dartmouth Medical School. Welcome, Dr. Fisher. The president is talking about high-quality care, below-average cost. You've actually gone out there and started comparing costs and health care outcomes, as they're called, around the country. So give us a map here. Who's getting it right? Who's getting it wrong?
Well, there are huge differences in spending on the Medicare population across the country. Patients in Miami receive about $17,000 per year in Medicare services, and patients in Minneapolis, half of that. There are dramatic differences. And most of the differences we see aren't due to the kinds of evidence-based practices that we think, that we know actually improve care. What happens to patients in the high-cost regions is they spend more time in the hospital, they're admitted more frequently, they see their physicians much more frequently, they're more likely to be referred to specialists, and they get lots more diagnostic tests and imaging procedures.
All right. You were saying, you know, that's where there are higher costs, but I'm wondering, what does that tell us about the health care outcomes? I mean, are people healthier in one area, and is that because they're getting more care or less care?
Well, there are differences in health across the country.
Yeah.
But when you control or look at patients who are similarly ill, what you see is twofold differences in spending again, but no improvement in outcomes or quality in the higher cost regions of the country. In fact, it's the opposite. The quality is a little bit worse on average in higher spending communities, and the health outcomes for the populations that live there are actually a little bit worse. If you've had a heart attack or a hip fracture in the higher spending regions of the United States, you're slightly less likely to survive for the 5 years after that event.
Wow. So what can we extrapolate from that and push to these other places in the country? In other words, if they're doing it better, cheaper somewhere, what's the takeaway?
Well, there are probably a couple of things. The high-cost communities have an awful lot of medical specialists. The lower-cost communities have many more primary care physicians, so much stronger primary care systems. And there are a few other things that are emerging from the current research. First is, it seems very important to have, you know, an organized system of care. Places like Grand Junction, Colorado, or Green Bay, Wisconsin, the physicians have come together to say, let's have a shared electronic record. Even though we're in our own individual office practices, let's work on a common record so everyone, when they come to see us, a physician can have exactly the same information, you know, about that patient. So they have a shared electronic record. They measure their performance. They compare themselves to each other, and they compare themselves to other places around the country. So they're trying to improve the quality of care they deliver to the population of patients. I mean, one of the most remarkable things for physicians is how invisible their practice is to themselves unless they step back and collect some information and look at these differences in practice.
All right, so that sounds like a systemic reform, but how likely are we to see that in the days ahead as people argue about what we're going to do with health care?
I think there's very strong interest in all the congressional committees in trying to help support reform of the delivery system that helps physicians provide better care and lower the cost of care, helps physicians and hospitals learn to work together. I mean, much of the public discussion over the last couple of weeks has been about cutting prices.
Mm-hmm.
But the real differences in spending and the real opportunities for improvement are in the overall quantity of care that is delivered to patients. If you cut prices, hospitals will just have to provide more of other kinds of services. We want to focus on helping groups become accountable for the overall cost and quality of care for the patients they serve. There have been some very impressive demonstrations recently run by the Medicare program that put physicians and hospitals together and then reward them for providing better care at lower cost, and those are starting to have some effect. We're expecting the legislation to include that kind of support for those kinds of changes.
I'm also wondering, are we going to see reform that actually focuses on individuals? In other words, teaching people how to talk to their physician? I think a lot of us have had the experience. You're in the room and you're supposed to explain this pain, and all of a sudden words fail you.
There certainly needs to be much better public education about a variety of things, from how to take care of yourself and keep yourself healthy, to how to communicate effectively with physicians. But I think in the current system, where most of us are experiencing the quick 5-minute visit, there isn't even time for the physician to let you finish the sentence when you walk into the office, much of the benefit from policy changes and from changing the delivery system will be allowing physicians and patients to have more time to talk together. A wonderful experiment done in Kaiser Permanente, not an experiment, but they implemented ways of communicating by email and telephone easily with your physician. And they found that, you know, about 30% of the office visits went away. That left much more time for the patients who were actually being seen and needed to be seen to talk to their physicians. They found referrals to specialists after that happened fell by 30%. Probably because patients had time to talk to their physicians.
All right, now I want a different sort of prognosis from you. Every time we hear that there's going to be talk about healthcare reform, you sort of want to get down in the bunker and get ready for battle. What do you think it's going to look like?
Well, I'm very optimistic that we will advance the critical features of payment reform that starts to reward value rather than volume. That will help physicians and hospitals come together. I think over the next couple of months, we're going to see the usual fight between interest groups that are worried about something happening to their own personal incomes. But our research has shown that there's plenty of money in the U.S. healthcare system. And simply by slowing the growth a little bit, still allowing healthcare costs to go up, we could save all the money we need to save to help fund the cost of covering the uninsured.
All right. Thanks so much for your time, Doctor. That's Dr. Elliot Fisher, a professor of medicine and the director of the Center for Health Policy Research at Dartmouth Medical School.
Catherine, I have a confession to make.
Uh-huh. This better be good.
I just Googled Dr. Fisher. I wanted to find out if he looked as good as he sounds. And absolutely. So,
Femi,
we are talking this morning about the price of things,
yeah,
not
back to
just
the
healthcare.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, getting back on message.
Yeah,
economists say that the recession might end this summer. Tell us how you know if the economy is getting better by filling in the blank. So when I see the price of blank go down, I know the economy is getting better.
Hi, this is Patrick, and I'm calling to say that my economic indicator is the price of a gallon of milk. I live in Michigan, but I go to school in Louisiana, and in Louisiana, milk is almost $2 more per gallon. And when I got back to Michigan, it had gone up almost $2 per gallon.
877-8-MY-TAKE, or send us an email, mytake@thetakeaway.org. How do you know if the economy is getting better? Let's take a look and see what our takeaway is. We've been keeping an eye on Iran this morning.
Iran is a controlled society, but it's not really a closed society. And one reason it's not is because of things like text messaging and websites. And a lot of Iranians, particularly the middle class, are on Facebook.
I'm Femi Okay.
I'm Catherine Lanfer.
This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
Today I'm proud to issue a presidential memorandum that paves the way for long overdue progress in our nation's pursuit of equality.
The president makes it easier for gay federal employees to get some benefits, but life as a gay American is still a chore.
It's a little bit of a grocery list, as it were. You have to pick up the laundry, you have to go ahead and run a few errands. Oh, and by the way, you have to try to get equal protection under law.
In search of a more perfect union, it's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Thursday, June 18th. I'm Catherine Lanfer. John Hockenberry's away. And I'm here with Femi. Okay, good morning, Femi.
Hi there, Catherine. Good morning, everybody. Coming up this hour, we hear from the New York governor, the former New York governor, Eliot Spitzer, and get his take on the Obama administration's financial overhaul. We'll also be discussing the contested Iranian elections with the Indiana Congressman Mark Pence, and he chairs the House of Republican Conference. Those stories coming up, but first, headlines. In Iran, in the country's governing Guardian Council, is inviting the three defeated candidates in the country's contested presidential election to voice their complaints in a meeting on Saturday. Now, this news comes according to Iranian state media. It's the first public indication that the government is prepared to engage in some form of political discussion. Meanwhile, supporters for the primary challenger, Amir Hussein Mousavi, is rallying in downtown Tehran. Mazia Bahari is a journalist and documentary filmmaker who has been demonstrating in Tehran every day this week.
People just don't know what's going to happen. The majority of the people, they want to have some sort of reform of the government, and they want another election because they think that this election was fraud and the votes were rigged.
Today, protesters are being urged to wear black to the rally, and it has been declared a day of mourning for those who were killed in protests this last week. Catherine.
Hey, looking for a new house, Femi? NASA is starting to scout out property on the moon. It's launching an unmanned rocket this afternoon that will search for possible colony sites as well as hidden ice. This marks NASA's first mission to the moon in a decade. Back on Earth, Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner will be on Capitol Hill this afternoon. He's expected to take questions on the plan that President Obama unveiled yesterday to revise the country's financial regulatory system. The proposal was well received among Democrats, but is receiving criticism from members of the GOP. And investigators are criticizing the U.S. efforts to stop the flow of guns from the U.S. to Mexico. Government investigators say there's no clear plan to fight gun runners linked with drug cartels. This is all according to testimony expected to be delivered by Congress to Congress by the Government Accountability Office.
We have some new jobless numbers out this morning. Initial claims jumped a bit last week, though ongoing claims dipped sharply. On Wall Street yesterday, Dow and S&P both fell 0.1%, and the Dow opens today at 84.97. The S&P opens at 9.11. So, Catherine, we're talking about people's economic indicators. When do they think the recession might be over? So the question is, when I see the blank, then I know the economy is getting better, or at least it isn't getting worse. So what do the listeners have to do? They can email us.
They can fill in the blank.
Absolutely. 877-8-MY-TAKE.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Hello, you're listening to The Takeaway. Femi OK and Catherine Lanford taking care of you this morning. Catherine?
Hey, John Hockenberry's away. Now, as we all know, President Obama proposed sweeping changes to the regulation of the country's financial system. The powers of the Federal Reserve would grow under his plan. Hedge funds, similar private pools of money, would have to register with the SEC. There would even be a new Consumer Protection Agency. But does this actually address the root causes of the financial crisis? For another view, we're going to turn now to Eliot Spitzer. He, of course, is the former attorney general and former governor of the state of New York. You might recall, as attorney general, he sued companies like AIG for deception, fraud, and boosting the company's stock price. Thanks for joining us. Now, this plan is being hailed as a big reform, but is it the reform that we actually need?
Well, it is important and it is useful and it rationalizes many rules, but I think there is a fundamental misperception that it grants dramatic new powers to entities, and that had these entities, whether the Fed, the SEC, or any of the other welter of government agencies, had these powers in the past, somehow they could have avoided the crisis. The reality is they had all the power they needed to stop the crisis. They just didn't use the power.
Oh, no, hang on a minute. Where were those tools that people could have used? There's been a lot of reporting, for instance, on the Office of Thrift Supervision, saying that, in fact, they didn't have oversight over some of the areas, like with the credit security.
Well, unfortunately, those reports are wrong. I mean, if you look at what And again, I hate to point back to the office when I was Attorney General a number of years ago. What we were able to do with a very simple fraud provision in a state law, we were able to delve into the fundamental financial workings of every one of these major companies, from AIG to the major banks to the hedge funds on occasion. All you needed was a simple anti-fraud provision in a statute, and the Fed, the SEC, the OCC had all the power they needed to look at these entities and to set credit ratios, capital ratios, liquidity requirements. They just didn't do it. Now, I don't say this as though somehow, therefore, we should be angry at these folks. The new rules are fine. They're good. They rationalize. Creating a new consumer protection agency is very nice. But again, it does not grant new powers. It merely takes little bits and pieces of authorization that are already there at these entities and puts them in one home. The question is, where was the Fed when it had the capacity and affirmatively decided not to regulate derivatives? Where was the Fed when it affirmatively looked at all the major banks and let them go to ratios of 25 to 1 in terms of their capital ratios? And so the question really should be, have we learned from the crisis? And if the answer is we've learned, and therefore the next time we begin to see a bubble and an escalation of capital, the ratios or an escalation of leverage akin to what we saw in the past couple of years will react, that's good. But rearranging the deck chairs doesn't fundamentally alter the fact that the regulators had the power over the past few years.
Okay, you're asking the question, where was the Fed? What's your answer to that?
I think that they made an affirmative ideological choice not to intervene. And we have now read, and I remember when I read Alan Greenspan's autobiography, kind of being amazed, because here was somebody who was writing in these glowing terms about Ayn Rand and the notion of government should never intervene in the marketplace, and yet the Fed is the fundamental, most important regulator out there. It swamps the capacity of the SEC and the OCC, OTS, all the others. The Fed has the capacity to look at any entity on the street and say to them, you have too much debt, you have too much leverage, raise your capital ratios, you won't get access to the borrowing that we authorize. And this is the process by which it really regulates these entities. And they chose not to do so because the ideology of the last 30 years was let the individuals who were selling the credit default swaps and all the other sophisticated instruments, let them figure it out on their own, because they will understand when they have too much debt.
Okay, rearranging the deck chairs. Tell me how the Spitzer plan would be more than rearranging the deck chairs.
Well, look, I'm not there. I haven't crafted a specific alternative plan, and I'm not going to pretend that I could or I would in 30 seconds on air. But I would tell you this: the one thing I would say is put people at the Fed, put people at the SEC who affirmatively want to regulate. I'll give you one example. The OCC, this an entity that probably only one in a thousand of the listeners on the show has heard of or cares about, the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, has the capacity to stop the predatory lending and the sale of those sophisticated instruments that actually brought down the banks. When my office and many other AG's offices around the nation started investigating the sale of the subprime loans, because we said these are bad loans, they're both discriminatory in the way they're being marketed. They are debt that we believe is going to be burdensome and probably not the people who borrow will not be in a position to pay it back, and who knows what that does to the financial structure. The OCC didn't come in and say, yes, this is an important issue, let's take a look at it. They went to court to stop us from investigating the issue. They said, you are preempted, you can't ask these questions. Preempted being the sort of technical, legal, jurisdictional argument that as a state entity, which I was the state attorney general, we could not ask questions of federally chartered banks. Now, this may not sound like a terribly important issue, but all the banks in the OCC went to court and they won. The case is now pending in the United States Supreme Court. But those are the very loans and debts that then metastasized into the products that were then guaranteed by the credit default swaps that exploded to bring down the banks.
Well, in fact, this leads to another question, which is the Obama plan doesn't really lean or rely on states to act, and yet you would argue that's where you were able to be most effective.
Well, look, I think states are, it's a whole separate discussion about the interplay between state enforcement and federal enforcement. I think state enforcement can play a very important backstop function. It certainly should not be viewed as being the front line line of defense for improprieties in the marketplace. But what we need is an OCC that actually understands its obligation to ask the hard questions. A Fed that says your leverage ratios over the last couple of years were simply out of whack. a Treasury Secretary, now let's hope that Tim understands this, and you know, in the past they haven't, that derivatives can explode in a way that will be fundamentally hazardous to the financial system. So again, it's not, the rules are good, they're fine, but everybody's now saying, aha, new oversight over the rating agencies. The rating agencies, of course, slapped AAA status on all of the securitized debt that had within it the subprime loans that, of course, were not going to be paid back.
Mr. Spitzer, this is Femi Okeh listening in to you talking to Catherine this morning. Thank you for being with us on The Takeaway. You have so much great information at your fingertips. You're so knowledgeable. How frustrating is it that you're not really in the mix right now and getting to put your expertise to work?
Oh, look, there are lots of people out there who know it much more deeply than I, and they are working down at Treasury and at the Fed to put this together. These are good folks. And look, there's a lot of knowledge out there, and I'm now pursuing different options, and so be it. That's the nature of life.
You know, according to a poll in the New York Times, only 21% of New York voters say they have a favorable view of Governor Patterson, and you're polling at 26%. Given that you're the one who left the office in some disgrace, well, what do you make of those numbers?
Look, I was in politics long enough to know that letting poll numbers guide one's self-image is a very dangerous and hazardous thing to do. Poll numbers go up and down. You can even see articles in today's paper that President Obama's numbers are beginning to slip in some areas. You know, when you make tough decisions, your numbers go down. And that is the nature of leadership. I think that I had a great time and was thrilled to serve for 8 years as Attorney General, a shorter period of time, obviously, as governor. And I look back at that fondly, and now move forward. You just don't look back wistfully or look forward and say, gee, I wish I were. It's not productive.
Speaking of looking forward, we've been asking everyone this takeaway question today, which is, what is the economic indicator that you look at to tell you what's going on with the economy? What's yours?
Well, I'm going to give you a very real-life New York day-to-day example of how I will know when the recession is over. When you can walk out into the street in the rain during rush hour and get a cab, we're in a very serious recession. And the moment that I can't get a cab anymore, I will begin to feel that the economy's picking up. Right now, you know, it's raining this morning. I have no doubt I could get 10 cabs in 30 seconds. That's a bad sign for the economy.
You must be in a different corner of New York than we are. All right. And then quickly, one last question. And that is looking ahead at this financial reform that the president has suggested, what part do you think is actually going to happen?
I think most of it will happen because Congress feels a remarkable obligation to do something. And the beauty of passing a new law, and the reason legislators like to pass new laws and presidents like to sign them, is that it creates the impression that you've done something, that you've addressed the problem. And yet, as I'm arguing, the new law will not fundamentally address the problem that led to this crisis, which was the failure of regulators to use existing power. So, yes, we will get a new law that will capture many of these ideas, and they're fine ideas. There's nothing wrong with them. It's just that they don't go to the heart of what led to the crisis in the first place.
All right. Elliot Spitzer, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Elliot Spitzer, former attorney general and, of course, former governor of the state of New York. You're listening to The Takeaway.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
John Hockenberry is away. I'm Catherine Lanford.
And I'm Femi O'Kay. Now, this morning we're getting reports from our partners, the BBC, that thousands of people, many of them dressed in black, are now protesting in Tehran, in Iran, in a square in the southern part of the city. What we wanted to do was get a little closer to what's happening down on the ground. So we're going to talk live to Babak Deganpache. He is the Middle East correspondent for Newsweek. Babak, thanks for joining us. Good morning.
Thanks for having me on, Tim.
What's the scene that you can paint for us so we get a little better sense of what's happening?
I'm hearing the same from sources that I've talked to, that there are a large number of protesters gathering in Imam Khomeini Square in the southern part of Tehran, as you mentioned. They're there to commemorate the people who have been killed in the previous demonstrations earlier in the week. Again, they're wearing black to signify that. Now, the other side, the supporters of Ahmadinejad, have also called for their own supporters to come out into the street today at the same location. So we're possibly going to be looking at a pretty tense situation, possibly with clashes, as things continue here in the coming hours.
How are you able to get into the story, the personal stories, rather than just the broad, the opposition are doing this, the Ahmadinejad supporters are doing this? How do you get the sense of what people are really feeling and thinking?
Well, I guess the whole point is really just to talk to people, if it's not even at the demonstrations, but outside. I mean, talking to the people sort of behind the scenes of some of the campaigns, both from the Ahmadinejad side and the Mousavi side, and see what they're thinking, and really try to get a broader sense of what's going on. On the political front, away from the demonstrations, the Guardian Council has apparently called a meeting with representatives of the candidates for Saturday. So there does seem to be some move on the political front, or the trying to resolve this crisis about the election results also.
How likely is it that Mousavi is going to show up at today's gathering?
I would say it's pretty likely. He showed up at a massive rally on Monday. That was more or less unexpected. This one today, he has more or less announced that he will be there on his website, I believe. So I do think that he will show up, which will probably be a big sign of support to his supporters there.
Now, you've covered some hot spots. You've been in Iraq, you've been in Baghdad. How does the way this story is developing compare to some of those other big stories that you've worked on? Can you make comparisons even?
Well, there's certainly tension, there's certainly violence here, but there's nothing along the lines of the chaos and sort of disorder that you would see in a place like Baghdad. I mean, essentially at the moment, this is a political crisis. There's nobody that's speculating that this is really anything severely sort of beyond that. So at the moment, I think we'll just have to see what sort of evolves on the political front. And I do think that there will be some sort of resolution, perhaps pretty soon, in the next week to 10 days, to resolve this crisis.
And when you say a resolution, one change of a letter and we have revolution. A lot of people have been trying to figure out exactly what kind of change is going to come about. It sounds like you're thinking less of an upheaval and more of, as you said, a resolution.
I do, because frankly, nobody within the protesters is really calling for the downfall of the regime. That's not sort of what's in the cards. That's not what they're calling for. Essentially, the people, just calling for a investigation into the elections. The Mousavi side is calling for a cancellation of the election results. I mean, they're not basically calling for the overthrow of the regime. They're not calling for a revolution. So I do think that isn't a correct way to analyze this. And essentially, I do think those people who are involved, let's say Mousavi on the one side, Ahmadinejad on the other, and the bodies who are supervising the elections, like the Guardian Council, they will come to some sort of, a resolution, whether that means a cancellation of the vote, which to me seems less likely, or, a more thorough investigation to appease the supporters of Mousavi remains to be seen.
It's hard to sort of align here. We have, on the one hand, analysts saying, look, tanks could be brought in, we could have clashes today, and people are dying over a resolution?
Well, I mean, it may seem extreme, but frankly, that may be the case. I certainly don't see a situation where tanks will be brought out into the street. I think whoever's saying that is vastly overstating the case, and they're not here on the ground to see what's going on. And I do think that at the end of the day, there will be a political resolution to this. I don't see you know, this ending in anarchy and chaos in the way some people may be speculating.
We're getting a lot of information out and internet information out from the Mousavi supporters. How about the Ahmadinejad supporters? It seems to have gone very quiet. Other than seeing their protesting down on the ground, how much information are you getting from them?
Well, I mean, they're not difficult to reach. You know, the Ahmadinejad side does have their own campaign office. If we want to talk to the people who organized his campaign, we can talk to them. I mean, certainly there's all of the officials who worked in his previous administration. We can talk to them, and his supporters on the ground as well. You know, that we can track them down. And as you said, you know, there have been a couple of rallies to show support for him. Like I mentioned earlier also, that there is going to be a pro-Ahmadinejad rally at the same location today, so we potentially will see his supporters out. But I think we will see a lot of the Ahmadinejad supporters also tomorrow at Friday prayers, because the Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei is scheduled to be leading those prayers, and more than likely a lot of Ahmadinejad supporters will be there.
Babak, thank you for keeping track of the latest for us from Tehran in Iran. Babak Deganpeshe is the Middle East correspondent for Newsweek. Time now to catch up on the news headlines with Mark Garrison. Mark.
Thank you, Femi. 28 minutes after the hour. The debate between the U.S. and Israeli governments over West Bank settlements is kicking up in public. Israeli Foreign Minister Avigdor Lieberman visited the U.S. to meet with Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and others. He flatly refused an American request while standing right next to Clinton.
We cannot accept this vision about absolutely, completely freezing of settlements. I think that we must keep the natural growth.
Clinton stressed the Obama administration's view that settlement building must halt.
I think that the whole issue that you've raised is one that we've expressed our opinion on.
The American opinion includes support for a Palestinian state. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu does say he could accept a Palestinian state under strict conditions. The latest jobless figures are now out. New weekly claims jumped a bit, but the number of people getting ongoing unemployment benefits did drop sharply. That new report makes a connection from those layoff numbers to health care. Employers who offer health coverage could see a 9% surge in cost next year. PricewaterhouseCoopers says cost could rise in part because workers worried about losing their jobs are using their health insurance more while they still have it. Turning overseas, the security minister in the East African country of Somalia has been assassinated in a suicide bombing. Several others were killed in the blast. Somalia's president blames the attack on Al-Qaeda. Finally, there's news about the Air France plane that crashed off the coast of Brazil last month. Investigators are narrowing their theories. They now say the plane broke apart in the air. Some investigation and new analysis of what they have in front of them says there was not a fire on board the flight. Catherine and Femi.
All right.
Thanks,
Thank
Mark.
You, Mark.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org and by the Freeman Foundation.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of home, auto, and life insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Hello there, Femi OK and Catherine Lamford taking care of you this morning. John Hockenberry is away. Now, economists say the recession might end this summer, but do you believe them? Tell us how you'll know if the economy is getting better by filling in the blank. So let me give you an example. When I see blank, then I know the economy is getting better, or at least it isn't getting worse.
Good morning. This is Chris from Brooklyn. In terms of the economy, I have no idea. I think we're all just like a leaf on the wind.
So call us to fill in the blank. Maybe it might be a little bit more optimistic than that one. 8778 My Take. Send us an email at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
It was poetic, at least, Femi.
It was a beautiful thing.
There you go.
But miserable.
Now, on Wednesday, President Obama signed a memorandum that extends some benefits to the same-sex partners of federal employees.
Many of our government's hardworking and dedicated and patriotic public servants have long been denied basic rights that their colleagues enjoy for one simple reason. The people that they love are of the same sex.
But just how big a step was it? The Defense of Marriage Act, DOMA, is still in place, and many say that until that act is repealed, any step to expand gay and lesbian civil rights is going to be a baby step. Now, for some answers, we're here with Kenji Yoshino. He is the Chief Justice Earl Warren Professor of Constitutional Law at New York University's School of Law. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
First off, what does this new rule not allow? In other words, what are the benefits they're not going to be getting?
Yes, it's a great question. I think it's really important to underscore that President Obama emphasized that full health benefits or death benefits were not being provided to federal employees because this would actually be in conflict with the Defense of Marriage Act of 1996.
So what benefits did people get?
Well, the benefits that people get are fairly de minimis. He mentioned as one of his examples the fact that federal employees who were stationed abroad could give access to medical facilities to their spouses.
All right. So tell me how this fits in the larger general pattern of the Obama administration and those who are seeking to get equal rights, civil rights for gays and lesbians.
Well, it is a baby step, as you described. It's really important because, first of all, the federal government is the largest single employer in the United States. It's also even more important because this is the first pronouncement that President Obama has made in terms of gay rights.
Now, for people who are supporters of that, is this feeling a little late in the administration?
Absolutely. This is being described as too little too late and also as passive and reactive in the sense that many people in the LGBT community were recently outraged by a Department of Justice brief that was filed last week in defense of the Defense of Marriage Act, in which same-sex marriages were compared to incestuous unions.
Now, what do you mean by that?
What I mean is that in defending the Defense of Marriage Act, which does two things. It finds marriages between one man and one woman, and it also says that states don't need to recognize marriages that are engaged in other states. So if Massachusetts permits same-sex marriages, that means that no other state under this law has to recognize that Massachusetts marriage if its own laws, you know, say otherwise. So in defending this Defense of Marriage Act, which is a piece of federal legislation, what the Department of Justice did was to say that, well, oftentimes, even though marriage is usually controlled by a place of celebration rule, which is to say if it's valid in the place of celebration, then you have to accept it as valid in your state. So you know, something is valid, if a heterosexual union is valid in Massachusetts, generally New York will recognize it, that under this statute, New York doesn't have to recognize marriages that are engaged in Massachusetts if they're same sex. And making that argument, there are other instances that were adduced, and one of them was if there's an incestuous marriage that's legal in another country, say between an uncle and a niece, then a state would not be forced to recognize that. And so there's a comparison made between same-sex marriages and incestuous unions.
Okay, you said passive and reactive. But there are those who I think would argue that President Obama has always been a sort of cool operator. I mean, he had the same sort of reaction, if you will, to abortion issues. There's a lot of hot button issues where he stays in the center and reacts cautiously, if you will.
Yes, and in fact, as somebody who considers himself to be an ardent Obama supporter and as someone who considers himself also to be an ardent gay rights activist, what I want to encourage the LGBT community and allies to do is to be as temperate and as steely as President Obama is himself, which is to say that I don't think we should be hysterical or angry, I think that we should keep the pressure on. So President Obama has made a number of promises concerning the repeal of the Defense of Marriage Act, Don't Ask, Don't Tell, hate crimes legislation, the Employment Non-Discrimination Act. We have to hold his feet to the fire, but we have to do it in a calm, measured, and temperate way.
Kenji, on our website at thetakeaway.org, we have this great global map of where same-sex partnerships actually exist lawfully, maybe just partially. Is there a role model somewhere in the world where you think that's what we should be trying to do in the United States?
That's a terrific question. I mean, I really like the Spain for this reason, because Spain did it through the legislature rather than through the judiciary. And I think that the decision that made me jump up in the air, Femi, was not the 7-0 opinion in Iowa, which was a judicial opinion, but rather the legislative vote in Vermont that followed that same week by one vote. And I would much rather have same-sex marriage be legalized through the legislature rather than through the judiciary, because it gives the imprimatur of democracy to the unions.
Right.
And have a listen. We have a clip here coming up. This is Melba Ubreo. We spoke to her after the president's announcement yesterday. She and her wife are plaintiffs in a Massachusetts lawsuit challenging the Defense of Marriage Act.
We do our taxes at the state level. We are able to do our taxes jointly as a married couple, but when we do our taxes at the federal level, we definitely have to separate ourselves and file as a single woman. Between 2004 and 2007, we lost over $19,000 by not being able to file jointly.
Talk about how the DOMA can stand in the way of a couple's rights in a case like this.
Absolutely. It creates a huge confusion because you can be married under state law but not married under federal law. So, for example, when Jerry Studs, a representative from Massachusetts, died, under state law his remains were released to his partner, but its death benefits, which are controlled by federal law, could not be transmitted.
All right. Kenji, I want to thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Kenji Yoshino. He is the Chief Justice Earl Warren Professor of Constitutional Law at New York University's School of Law. We're going to turn now to Mark Garrison, who's in our endowed chair for headlines.
Not quite so exalted, but I'll try and live up to that. It's 20 minutes before the hour. In Iran, thousands of marchers, many dressed in black and holding candles, are gathered in Tehran for a new election protest. They're loyal to presidential challenger Mir Hussein Mousavi. They say the government rigged the vote to give it to incumbent Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. The World Bank is boosting its outlook on China. The bank now says China's economy will grow by 7.2%. That is a real jump, more than half a percentage point above the previous forecast. In the U.S., Chrysler will reopen 7 North American assembly plants by the end of the month. That comes after it stopped work at all its factories for 6 weeks while reorganizing under bankruptcy protection. And NASA is aiming for the moon today to scout out possible sites for future space dwellings. The unmanned rocket launches the first moon mission in a decade. Catherine and Femi.
Thank you, Mark.
Thanks, Mark.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Femi OK.
I'm Catherine Lanfer. Mir Hussein Mousavi has become the public face of Iran's protest movement, the man protesters consider the true winner of the disputed presidential election. His followers have even begun calling him the Gandhi of Iran. But who is he really? We're here again with Professor Hamid Dabashi. He's a professor of Iranian studies at Columbia University and the author of Iran, A People Interrupted. All right, Professor, how much of a contrast really is Mousavi to Ahmadinejad?
Day and night. That's the difference. Every revolution has an idealist, high aspirations, and has a demagoguery and charlatanism to it, every revolutionary movement. Mousavi represents, after 20 years of being in political isolation, those ideals and aspirations for which he fought during the revolution.
You make it sound like he's been frozen in amber.
He left. He was the prime minister between 1918 and 1988 during the war. And after the war ended and the territorial integrity of the country was preserved in part because of his premiership, he left. He went into isolation. He went to painting. He's an abstract painter. And so is his wife. And he didn't want to have anything to do with politics. I was in Iran in 1997. I wanted to see him, but he was not interested in anything contemporary or political.
What danger are we in right now, though, of painting an erroneous picture of him, the Gandhi of Iran?
Okay. He has quite a number of dead skeletons in his closet during the war, during, for example, the crackdown on opposition in the 80s, during the purging of the university from oppositional forces when he was prime minister. However, this 20 years of isolation, and then you have to remember that there is a dialectical relationship between the movement that has been unleashed and he. In other words, the movement is reconfiguring him. He may actually rise to the occasion. Tempered anesthesia, if I may to borrow a phrase from your previous guest, this is the way that he's being tested. The reason that people are calling him Gandhi or Nelson Mandela or Martin Luther King is precisely because this, if this movement is to have a snowball chance in hell to succeed, it has to be nonviolent civil disobedience. So it is the movement that is reconfiguring Mousavi as the leader of such a movement.
Professor, is the movement about him as a person, or is it just that the time is right?
The time is right. The movement is not just about him. That is, the entire question of the election and rigging it or not rigging it is an excuse, is the proverbial straw that broke the camel's back. And as a result, it's very unpredictable how this relationship is going to unfold as we go on. The fact of the matter is that the pent-up anger that now is being unleashed in these demonstrations are not just about this election. There are hosts of civil rights, human rights, women's rights, freedom of expression, freedom of press, etc., that are pent up, unemployment from economic to social to political factors that are all coagulated in this particular movement. To what degree Mousavi can actually deliver to what this crowd wants, it remains to be seen.
All right, that's Professor Hamid Dabashi. Thanks so much for being here. He's, of course, a professor of Iranian studies at Columbia University and the author of Iran, A People Interrupted, and Islamic Liberation Theology, Resisting the Empire. And we should mention, Femi, that we're not done with him yet.
Oh, no. He's a walking encyclopedia of Iran. So we are going to ask you, professors, to stay with us and then come back in a later conversation. So you'll be back in about 2-3 minutes' time. You're listening to The Takeaway with Femi Okay
and Catherine Lanfer.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to helping safeguard businesses and employees through comprehensive insurance products and services. More information at libertymutualgroup.com. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
I'm Catherine Lanfer here in the studio with Femi Okay. John Hockenberry is away. Now, coming up, we're going to be talking soon to Congressman Mike Pence. He's an Indiana Republican who thinks that President Obama should be showing more solidarity with Mousavi's supporters in Iran. But we're also talking this morning about the economy. Economists say the recession might end as early as this summer. Do you believe them? Well, we're asking you this morning to fill in the blank. You know, as in, when I see blank, then I know the economy is getting better, or at least it's not getting worse.
This is Terry from Detroit, and I'll know the economy is better when I start to see rush hour traffic again.
Okay, call us to fill in your blank, 877-8-MY-TAKE, or send us an email at mytake@thetakeaway.org. Now here's a blank to fill. We need news. Mark Garrison?
Here to help. It's 12 minutes before the hour. Pakistani officials say at least 8 are dead after a suspected U.S. missile strike in the northwest. The target was an apparent Taliban hideout for a local commander there. The security minister in the East African country of Somalia is dead after a suicide bombing. The president of Somalia blames the attack on al-Qaeda. On Capitol Hill, a high-level Republican in the Senate is stepping down from his party leadership post. Nevada Senator John Ensign admits to cheating on his wife. He says he will keep his Senate seat, though. And finally, being furry and cute is no shield in a tough economy. The Atlanta Zoo's giant pandas facing a layoff of sorts unless the zoo can raise $500,000.
I know those pandas.
You've been there. You were in Atlanta like that.
My old home.
So you may also know China rations out pandas very carefully. Zoos have to pay big bucks to get them. Atlanta's current panda lease is running out, and a new 5-year deal will cost the zoo $2.5 million total. So the zoo is essentially begging the public for the rest of the money. It's got to raise $500,000. They're optimistic, but it's a good bit of money. But people have to step forward to do that.
Furry and cute used to be a guarantee.
No.
That's why Jay works here. Possible. Jay's our board operator. Hope we don't have to lease him off.
You got it. That's
so not going
Catherine.
There. She lives dangerously, you know that?
Go for it.
I have some more news picking up where Mark Garrison left off. Of course, all week we have been following the presidential election in Iran and the protests over the disputed result. Now, the protests are still continuing today, and President Obama has said he doesn't want to interfere.
It is up to Iranians to make decisions about who Iran's leaders will be. We respect Iranian sovereignty and want to avoid the United States being the issue inside of Iran.
Now, some Republicans are urging the president to show solidarity with Mousavi supporters. Joining us is Congressman Mike Pence. He's a Republican from Indiana and also chairman of the House Republican Conference. Good morning, Congressman.
Good morning, Femi. Good to be on The Takeaway.
It's good to have you. Tell us, what is your issue with the Obama administration's stance on what's happening in Iran right now?
Well, look, I appreciate the fact that the president has said that protesters have a right to be heard and respected, and I appreciate that he's expressed the fact that he's troubled by the violence and the repression that's been in evidence over the last 6 days. But I respectfully disagree that for the president to speak out in a way that would express the unqualified support of the American people for the citizens of Iran who are taking a stand for basic human rights, free elections, freedom of expression, would be wrong. But that, look, I don't begrudge the president's ability and right to draw the line where he sees fit. That's why I've authored a resolution in the Congress that I hope it comes to the floor this week that would give the American people the opportunity through their elected representatives to express support, not for Mr. Mousavi or any particular opposition candidate, but for the people who have crowded the street for most of the last week, risking their liberty and in some cases risking their lives on behalf of fundamental freedom.
So let's make this distinction. It looks like the Obama administration are sitting on the fence, and given the chance, you would actually make a very distinct way of saying we would like to support the opposition in Iran.
Well, I want to be very clear on this. I think Mr. Mousavi and his agenda are, as we'd say here in Indiana, not a real picnic. I mean, there's not a bright line choice between the two. But I think that the people who are crowding the streets because they see the election as having been stolen. They want free and fair elections. They want democracy. They want the right to be heard and to embrace essential fundamental freedoms. We ought to, the American people, if our president chooses not to do so, I believe through our elected representatives, the American people ought to have the opportunity to express solidarity with the brave men and women who are taking a stand for essential freedoms in Iran. I think it represents an extraordinary opportunity for the people of our country to have what may be the beginning of a truly fresh start with the people of Iran.
Representative, this is Catherine Lanfer here. The American people have all sorts of ways to express how they are feeling about the protests that are going on in Iran. What about the fact that, you know, there are those who say, look, we actually play into the hands of the supporters of Ahmadinejad when we do something that has any kind of imprimatur of the government, a congressional resolution? We're going to have the Swedish ambassador back in Ahmadinejad's office with charges of U.S. meddling in the election.
Yeah, it's a fair point, Catherine, and I want to be real clear. I could care less what the tyrants in Tehran think about is the opinion and the regard of freedom of the American people in our government.
But you're making it sound like there's a huge difference.
Let me be clear on this point, if I can.
Mm-hmm.
I do believe that throughout the history of this country, we have, regardless of short-term diplomatic political calculations, when we have seen people around the world risking their liberty and their lives for their own fundamental freedoms, we have at least stood with them rhetorically. And if the administration chooses to take a more careful approach, I'll respectfully disagree, but that's the president's line to draw. I simply believe that the people of the United States of America would welcome the opportunity, and their elected representatives would welcome the opportunity to speak a word of support for those brave souls in Iran.
Okay, Congressman, we actually have an Iranian expert in the studio listening to you right now. He's Professor Hamid Darbashi. He's Professor of Iranian Studies at Columbia University, shaking his head at some of the comments you're making. Professor?
Well, in the spirit of conversation, I also respectfully disagree with the Congressman from Indiana. I think President Obama has stated the position extremely cautiously and extremely well. We have taught him very well at Columbia University. He has, in very certain terms, expressed solidarity with the demonstrators and the rallies without taking very explicit side. The reason is the history of United States involvement beginning with the coup of 1953 forward. Any more statement other than that, the way that the congressman is suggesting, is the kiss of death to this movement. You have to stay away from the movement. I do agree with the congressman that the American people have to find a way to express it, but not through the Congress. The hypocrisy of this position is that the night before the election in Iran, in the Congress, you actually started initiating a more severe sanctions against Iran, which the following day in Iran would have meant support for Ahmadinejad. And now that the movement has started, any involvement of United States congressmen in support of the rally means support for Ahmadinejad.
Congressman.
Well, I absolutely support the strongest possible sanctions against Iran as they move in the direction of a headlong rush of obtaining a nuclear weapon. President Ahmadinejad is a Holocaust denier who has expressed the ambition to wipe Israel off the map. Now, that being said, I want to grant the professor's point. I think for the United States to have expressed a perspective on these elections before the ballots were closed, before the voting was closed.
Congressman, I'm just going to ask you for one single statement to wrap up with because we're close to the end of our program. Just very quickly, one comment.
The American cause is freedom. And in that cause, we must never be silent. If the president chooses to take a more measured approach, as some experts would suggest. I'll respectfully disagree. But Congress ought to give the American people a chance to speak out for freedom.
Respectfully disagreeing with each other, we have Mike Pence. He's the Indiana Republican representative. And we also have Professor Hamid Darbashi, Professor of Iranian Studies at Columbia University. Thank you both, gentlemen.
All right, Femi, you know, all this morning we've been asking you when you will know if the economy is getting better, and we've been asking you to fill in the blank, as in, when I see blank, I know the economy is improving.
Hi, my name is Cliff Martin. I'm going to notice that the economy is getting better when the price of gold go down.
All right, that's from Michael. And oh, this is from Michael. Here's something good about the economy. I just got a new job.
Congratulations.
Okay. All right. And
here, goes wild.
Here's your recession takeaway.
Have we learned from the crisis? And if the answer is we've learned, and therefore the next time we begin to see a bubble and an escalation of capital akin to what we saw in the past couple of years, we'll react, that's good. But rearranging the deck chairs doesn't fundamentally alter the fact that the regulators had the power over the past few years.
All right, rearranging the deck chairs. Elliot Spitzer, former Attorney General and former Governor of the State of New York. I'm Catherine Lanfer.
I'm Femi Okeh, and you're listening to The Takeaway. Have a great day.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.